Nacho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
So I'm very excited to welcome the next guest. I know you guys hear me say that often, but as I like to say, I'm a failed music critic pretending to be a calcio writer. You guys know I love music, and the person we are going to talk about next, Chris Cornell, has been a huge influence on my life. So we were wanting to do something a little bit different during quarantine. I've been trying to bring some new guests on, so I took the courage to ask Corbin Reef, who is one of my favorite music writers. You can read him on Billboard, Rolling Stone, Pop Rocks. Like, I just love all his tweets on music and his articles, but more importantly, he is the author of Chris Cornell's upcoming biography called Total Effin' Godhead, which will be released in late July. We've talked about Cornell in the past on the show, but not quite like today. So, Corbin, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to Calcio Land.
I'm stoked to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, before we get into Chris Cornell's career and why you wanted to write this book, I'd like to start here. I love rock biographies. I've read a ton of them. I know you have as well. So tell our listeners about maybe some of your favorite rock biographies. And were there any in particular that kind of inspired, guided your work on what you've been doing with Chris Cornell?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like yourself, I'm definitely a connoisseur of rock biographies, and I read quite a bit of them. In terms of ones that I've really enjoyed over the years, I think that my favorite of all time is a book about Neil Young called Shaky. It was written by Jimmy McDonough. He spent a lot of time with Neil and a lot of time with people who associate with Neil, and wrote this like 800-page opus about just Neil's career in this really funny, interesting, in-depth, well-researched way. It's just fleshes Neil out as a person in a way that I think that he can be a little bit untouchable, unreachable, and as like, you know, this gigantic figure of inexplicable decision making and whimsical songwriting. But Jimmy really kind of got to the essence of who he was, and I really love that book. Another book, Hellfire by Nick Tosches, which is a biography of Jerry Lewis. It's phenomenal. It evokes a lot of religious overtones and really compelling writing. Michael Azarod's Our Band Could Be Your Life is another great one. Not necessarily a rock biography, but more of a portrait of a lot of bands in the indie underground in the 80s. But, you know, one of the books that, it wasn't a rock biography, one of the books that really inspired me in terms of writing this project was Robert Caro's series on Lyndon Johnson. I just love the way Caro writes. I love the depth of research he puts in and the thought he puts in and how he leaves no stone unturned. And I really tried to, I mean, it's not a rock biography, but it's some amazingly well-researched, well-contextualized piece of work that I really recommend, whether you like politics or not. It's just really a great, great, great series of books.
So very interesting what you picked on Neil Young and getting to the essence of the person being written about. That sounds really, really interesting. So let's talk about Cornell. Before I ask you about his ties to Italy and how popular Soundgarden were in Italy, because I remember I was living there at the time, let me ask you more in general. What is it about Chris Cornell that makes him such a compelling figure for a biography?
Well, for me, I mean, you know, music's always my first love. Whenever I approach an artist or write about someone, I kind of want to get to the heart of the music, and the person, the character shapes that. What I found compelling about Chris as a person was just the way he shaped and created songs, and the way he never stuck to one style for too long. I mean, even if you look at Soundgarden from the beginning of what they started off with as this punk, post-punk indie band screaming his lungs out to, you know, Bad Motorfinger when they became more of a metal band, Super Unknown when they more psychedelic, and then, you know, Down on the Upside, you know, more hard rock. And then he goes into the solo career and takes off in a whole bunch of different directions. Temple of the Dogs, a whole different thing, which is, you know, classic rock. Seasons, the song he did for the single soundtrack. But then, you know, he does the James Bond theme, Casino Royale. He does the solo acoustic stuff. I mean, he was always constantly evolving as a songwriter and as a musical artist, and his influences were always changing, even though the Beatles were the bedrock for basically everything he'd done. Every album was always, Scream, even the album he did with Timbaland.
Yeah.
Very maligned. People have a lot to say about it, but, you know, I don't know that a lot of artists with his stature and his cachet in the world of rock would have swung us up fences like that. Even though it didn't necessarily work out artistically, it was something I really admired about him, is his ability to kind of push into new directions and challenge himself. And it, as you're writing about the same subject for so long, it's kind of refreshing to kind of come across a different album than the one you'd heard before. Especially yeah. if you've been going on it for three continuous years. I mean, it's nice to be able to kind of dive into different areas of his craft.
Yeah, no, I have to say, because of this interview, I actually was listening to Scream for the first time in years over the weekend. So when I first started messaging you about this interview, you know, I was telling you that, you know, I grew up on Soundgarden and I was living in Italy at the time. They were one of the openers on Guns N' Roses' first tour in Italy. It was a huge deal. Like, Italy actually has a really good musical culture. We had a TV station that showed a lot of videos, and I remember seeing the video for Rusty Cage, and that's when Soundgarden kind of came on my radar. But I was fascinated when I told you all this. You told me about how popular Soundgarden were in Italy, even before Bad Motorfinger, which I think that's really what launched them. So tell our listeners a little bit about that, because it's really fascinating.
Sure, yeah. You know, in the I think 1990-89 era, you know, when Hiro Yamamoto, the original founding bassist in Soundgarden, was still in the band, you know, they took their first tour to Europe and played all around Europe and England and everywhere else, and got to Italy, and the crowds in Italy were far crazier and more enthusiastic about Soundgarden than any other country they visited. I really couldn't figure out why that was, but for some reason Italy was mad for Soundgarden, to the point where they actually played a communist rally in Milan. And it was this pro-drug, like pro-every drug, like pro-heroin, pro-everything communist rally that they didn't know about. They didn't know what the premise of the rally was. They showed up there, and it was just a madhouse, a riot. Like, it was a full-scale riot, but like, the madness in the streets, and Soundgarden's in the middle of it. And people are wondering about, you know, what's Chris Cornell tearing up pictures of himself on the lamppost for? And it turns out he's paper for a set list. And they were just mad for them. Hiro Yamamoto's, I think, one of his last gigs in Soundgarden was actually in Italy. And ironically, so was Jason Evermans, who was Hiro's replacement. Matt Cameron came down with some food poisoning in Austria on a tour later on, and then played a gig in Italy shortly after that. He was able to recover just enough to play a show. And they went back to America shortly after that. Jason Everman was given the pink slip, and Ben Shepherd was brought in. So Soundgarden's history with Italy is very actually quite interesting. You wouldn't expect it, but they have some really interesting ties to that country.
That's really fascinating, because having been at some of the rallies that you described, that sounds really, really perfect. So very interesting there. So let me ask you, in the past you've ranked every Soundgarden song. You obviously, I can't think of anyone that knows their catalog as well as you. So I know which is your number one Soundgarden song, but not so much the best song. But I want to ask you, if someone that's not familiar with Chris Cornell at all, and you want to, you know, make them listen, understand why he's such a big deal to people like you and I, what three Soundgarden songs would you pick and why?
Well, let's set aside Black Hole Sun for a second, because I think everyone knows Black Hole Sun. You know, even if you don't know who Chris Cornell is, you don't know who Soundgarden is, you probably heard Black Hole Sun on the radio at some point or another. So if you're going to introduce someone to Chris Cornell, I would start with 4th of July, which you alluded to is what I think is his greatest song. And there's actually a really cool backstory to that song. He had this insane acid trip on Independence Day, and you know, while he was in the throes of this trip, he heard this chorus of voices trailing behind him. And when he turned around, he saw this figure clad in a black shirt and jeans and another person in a red shirt. And the more he tried to focus in on one, the other one seemed to kind of dip out of the way. And, you know, you'd think that would scare a normal person, it would terrify them. But he found the experience really calming. And he wrote this demented, twisted, like guttural, like apocalyptic song that's just so heavy based on this experience that he had, that I just feel is, it's not the loudest song or the most aggressive song he ever wrote, but it's just so vividly captures a mood that I think it's so fascinating to me. Another song I'd pick, Outshined. I know it's kind of more their hit from Bad Motorfinger, but I think it was important as his development as a songwriter. You know, that line, you know, looking California, feeling Minnesota. It so perfectly captures like what his feeling was and what kind of his duality. He was one of the first times he wrote about himself in a real meaningful way.
Would you say that's his most famous lyric overall?
It's definitely top three.
Yeah.
It's definitely up there, top three. They named a movie out of it, you know. It kind of goes to show the power of that lyric. But, you know, he looked in the mirror and saw this beach bum kid, but he's feeling depressed on the inside, and wrote about that dichotomy in a song. And I thought it's still compelling as hell. And then the third song I'd pick is Slaves and Bulldozers, just because that's Soundgarden. They're the most like Led Zeppelin-y, you know, just balls, especially live. They usually close their show out with it. And it just stretches on forever. There's feedback and there's an experience. Like, if I'm going to dial up a song on YouTube and just say, like, this is why Soundgarden was a great live band, I pick Slaves and Bulldozers.
Yeah, that's a great choice. I think, and you would know this, that's the song Rick Rubin played for the guys in Rage Against the Machine to the Audio Slave. I don't know if that's an urban legend or actually true, but when I hear that song, I always kind of think about that.
That's absolutely true. That's the one they were all going on the table, figuring out, trying, you know, what are we going to do next? Rick Rubin busts out Slaves and Bulldozers, Tom Morello and the rest of the guys are like, well, we should see about that guy. Yeah. And good that they did.
I would say so. Perfect segue. So you named three great Soundgarden songs. I like Outshined also, because I think Chris Cornell is a very underrated writer just of guitar riffs. That guitar riff is just filthy. But as you mentioned, there's Audio Slave, there's Temple of the Dog, there's his solo work. So if you had to pick three songs outside of the Soundgarden catalog that show his greatness, or maybe show the variety that he could do, which ones would you pick and why?
Okay, so let's go earlier days. I'll go with Seasons, because it's his first like official solo song, and it's this dark Led Zeppelin III acoustic piece that, you know, for people who were, you know, knew the guy as the Loud Love screamer, and you know, to that image of him as just this powerhouse vocalist to kind of take things down a notch and really just, you know, himself into a four-track tape with an acoustic guitar making this incredibly vivid music. It's even today it resonates. It's very powerful. I'll pick a Temple of the Dog song. I'm going to go Call Me a Dog.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's not the popular song on the album. Hunger Strike is the one that most people know with Eddie Vedder in that duet. But Call Me a Dog, if you want to talk about Chris Cornell as a singer, I think that's my favorite of his vocal performances. It's just the way he starts at this mid-tempo build of just kind of crooning the lyrics, and before the like that guitar solo, he just takes off into that, you know, that the stratosphere, and it just it gets me every single time. I really love the way he sings that song. And then let's go Audio Slave and Audio Slave cut. I'll go something a little unexpected. I'll Shadow on the Sun.
Awesome,
I really love
choice.
The way that he just. I love the way he just goes for that song. He screams his head off. You know, Like a Stone and I Am the Highway are probably, you know, more popular. Well, Like a Stone has almost 600 million views on YouTube, so it's definitely more popular. But the way that song was used in the movie Collateral, too, I always love that image of Jamie Foxx and Tom Cruise kind of like driving around L.A. at night with that song playing in the background. It's fantastic.
Awesome. Good stuff. Okay, so now let's talk a little bit more about the book, which I'm really dying to read. So tell us a little bit. How did you go about researching this book? And what about the process surprised you? Were there maybe some people that were more or less helpful than you expected? Did you go down a rabbit hole that ended up being very fruitful for you?
You know, I definitely went down several rabbit holes that were fruitful and not fruitful. You know, I've been working on this book for about 2.5 years, almost 3 years. Really going through the archives of the Seattle Public Library and every issue of the Seattle Times that ever mentioned Chris Cornell, Soundgarden, Audioslave, Seattle Post Intelligencer, interviewing dozens and dozens of people who knew Chris, trying to get, you know, original stories in the book too, not just stuff that people know. It was a process. I think the thing that, you know, the thing that's shown through most from people talking to people about Chris is, you know, he was a dynamic stage presence. He was able to project on stage, but he was also kind of a quiet, reserved guy off stage. You know, he didn't really divulge much of himself. So the kind of times, you know, when he would talk about himself or, you know, open up to other people were always really fascinating to me. And, you know, it's always fun to kind of learn about bands on the come up. So I love those early stories I got from people like Eric Johnson. You know, his nickname was Gunny Junk, who was their road manager and sold t-shirts on those initial tours. And he told me some great stories about, you know, playing in LA with Chris duct taping his shorts and doing erotic dances on stage and And then, you know, Stuart Hallerman, who was their longtime sound person for, I mean, their sound engineer for a long time on the road. He had some great stories about getting busted by the DEA in Louisiana for some bullshit charges of, you know, weed possession and almost didn't make the gig. And, you know, just those kinds of stories are always really fun. And it's a really cool way to think about Chris Cornell that's kind of different from your perception of the, you know, the MTV videos or the, you know, all that kind of thing.
Awesome. So you mentioned you did a lot of research on the early days of Soundgarden, looked at all the local papers in Seattle. So tell me a little bit, obviously you've been researching this book for multiple years after the process. How has your perception as Seattle as a place, city changed? And do you think there's something specific about that place that made it such a perfect place to launch grunge music? I think on the Pearl Jam movie, I think it's the guys on Alice in Chains said, hey, you know, it rains here a lot, so we have a lot of time to practice. Do you think it's something like that, or there's more to it that made Seattle such a perfect place for this type of music to launch?
Yeah, you know, I don't know how much my perception of Seattle changed specifically. I lived in this area for a long, long time, and then I moved away for a little bit, and I just recently moved back about half a year ago, or maybe a year. It's been a while, about a year ago or so. So it's obviously changed because there's more buildings everywhere.
Yeah,
flat out. But in terms of the grunge movement and why, you know, Seattle was such a great incubator for that, you know, the rain does have something to do with it, you know, and when you're inside for so many days of the year, because you don't want to go outside and walk around, you know, it's, you're bound to do something, and a lot of people pick up instruments. I mean, it is kind of sort of, you know, that aspect of it. There's also a natural beauty here, I think, that, you know, kind of gets overlooked. You know, you're surrounded by these evergreen trees and water and earth everywhere. And, you know, maybe some people are more attuned to that aspect of themselves. And Chris was a huge fan of the wilderness, and he loved to go on hiking, and he was a real outdoors person. And I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, people like that are more in tune with, you know, some sort of naturalistic view of the world, or more poetic about things, you know, if you're exposed to sort of a natural beauty. And one thing that helped a lot, especially in the 80s, when Soundgarden was first coming up, was just the isolation. You know, there's not many bands that came up to Seattle. You know, they didn't want to make the drive. There was, so if you wanted to see music, you saw local bands. And it fostered the scene where all the bands were kind of seeing each other, and they became friends, and they were helping each other and swapping members. And it wasn't a competitive thing, just because, you know, why would you be competitive with, you know, your friends? Why would you be competitive with the band you're on the bill with? I mean, there was some competition, obviously I'm not going to disregard that, but, you know, it was a real camaraderie, and it wasn't just a manufactured thing. So by the time that the world kind of discovered Seattle, there was all these deep ties between all the members. Like Susan Silver, Chris's wife, you know, managed Alice in Chains. She helped manage Screaming Trees, and she shared an office with Kelly Curtis, who managed Pearl Jam. So it was this deep, deep embedded feeling of camaraderie amongst the people that were in Seattle that I think really made it what it was.
Very interesting. So let's close on this. And I'm glad that honestly today we just focused on his life, his greatness, then get into, you know, how it ended and all. But I want to ask you, someone, you've been writing this book for over 2 years, your knowledge of music is second to none. When you think of Chris Cornell right now, do you see him as being underrated, overrated, properly rated? Because in my opinion, and Soundgarden has sold over 25 million records worldwide, he was an audio slave, Temple of the Dog, really well-known, Bond soundtrack, like on paper, I mean, he's one of the best-looking rock stars ever. I still feel he's pretty underrated, but that's just my opinion. What about yours?
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. One of the reasons why I wanted to write the book in the first place is because I felt like, you know, as I looked around at the shelves after he passed, I noticed that, you know, there's, you could fill bookcases with books about, written about Nirvana. There's a shelf you could fill with books about Pearl Jam. There's a book about Alice in Chains. But, you know, the only book that's written about Soundgarden was written in 1997. the band hadn't even broken up the first time yet. So,
yeah.
You know, there was this real lack of awareness, I think, or a lack of appreciation for what Chris and that band had accomplished in their time, and what he accomplished as a solo artist and an audio slave and all these other things. And I did feel that he was underrated, and I was hoping that, you know, if I could kind of shed some light on what he accomplished and the music he made in his life, especially as a songwriter. I think that people see this image of Chris as this perfect, you know, like chiseled, long haired dude, you know, screaming his head off, natural gifts. But he really, really, really worked hard to make himself into an incredible songwriter, starting out as a drummer, as a teenager, learning all these insane tunings and time signatures, like 11, 8, and playing every string in E, like doing these weird experiments because, you know, his, you know, knowledge of the guitar wasn't as, he wasn't an Eddie Van Halen. So he did all these other things to try to make unique songs. He bashed his head against the wall to really work hard to make himself into a person who was an excellent songwriter. I really respect that facet of his artistry. And I hope that when people read the book, they kind of come away with that as well and appreciate him more for his abilities to be a songwriter.
Well, Corbin, this was really awesome. I can't thank you enough. I cannot recommend enough this book. I can't wait to read it, but I know it's going to be great based on all your writing and your interview here today. So you guys can already pre-order it. Total F and Godhead. We are going to tweet the link as well. Comes out in late July. But Corbin, thank you so much for coming on. It was a real pleasure chatting with you. Thank you for paying such a great tribute to an artist that we really love on the podcast.
I had a blast. Thank you for having me.